I got the horse right here, the name is Paul Revere, and here's a guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, can do.
This is Bill Duncliffe with another edition of the Can Do Horse Racing Podcast, where the heroes and history of horse racing come alive, part of the In the Money Media Network. Those with long memories may remember the young female jockey Karen Rogers, who burst onto the scene at Hialeah Park in 1979 at the age of 16. Unafraid, her fearlessness belying her tender years, she quickly gained an appreciative audience of bettors enamored with her ability to bring in long shots and her willingness to ride hard to the wire in every race. Her youth, her style, her uniqueness as a young girl in a male-dominated sport, her proven ability to win along with her seemingly cheery disposition, soon propelled her to fame far beyond the track. Two appearances with David Letterman, Jane Pauley, a feature story in Us magazine. She even appeared as a contestant on the made-for-TV sports competition The Superstars, a weekend network staple that featured athletes from a variety of sports competing in a salad of competitions, none of which were their specialty. Like all overnight successes, however, Karen had an early start pursuing the sport that she loved.
Well, the angel came to see me today, said, "We've taken your race away."
You know, there's pictures of you in the book on horses when you're three, and you were actually race riding as a very young girl, right? And pony races that I don't even know if those even happen anymore. Do they,
They do. In fact, Rosie Napravnik, who grew up, she's a rider that came along after me and did extremely well. She grew up in the same town I did. And okay. So she has the same background, and her kids are doing pony races now, her little guys. So okay. They still have the pony races, but they've changed it a bit. They now have medium size instead of just large pony, small pony. It's the steeplechase races. There's this whole steeplechase circuit, and they have pony races that start before the steeplechase races. They're not on the track. Mm-hmm. They're at the hunt meetings, the steeplechase meetings in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Maryland, that area.
Okay. So how old were you when you rode? I mean, it wasn't your first official race as a jockey, but when you rode your first pony race, how old were you, Karen?
I was 11.
Oh, my gosh.
11 or 12.
Yeah.
Maybe just turned 12.
Okay. Were you nervous? I get the sense you were not nervous because you had kind of been around horses all your life up to that point, right?
I started riding when I was three, and it was just like, I wasn't like a horse crazy girl because they were just part of the family. It was just part of life, and they were a lot of work. So to me, it was just something we did. And in fact, racing is what I loved. I loved the speed and the competition. I showed, I couldn't stand showing because they judged you. It was subjective.
Okay.
And I didn't like subjectiveness. I like, you know, you either first, second, or third. And so I loved racing. I loved the speed. I loved the competition. I was just sold out on racing from the first time, you know, I actually went fast.
Yeah.
We used to fox hunt.
Go ahead.
I live in the area. Bridleton in the book is actually Bedminster, New Jersey, where there's fox hunting. And we used to fox hunt. Actually, Jackie hunted Onassis with her kids, John, and Carolyn. But I loved the speed. My pony would always, like, try to outrun everybody. So, anyway.
That's great.
Yeah.
She wasted no time establishing a name for herself once given the opportunity. In terms of being a professional jockey, Karen, you first, I think, were riding horses in the morning at Hialeah. And there were people who kind of picked up on, you know, how to sit on a horse and make the horse run, right?
Well, I started getting on horses on the track at 15 at Monmouth that summer. And
okay. Then
the following year, I couldn't wait to be 16. I would have been riding races at 12 if I could have. But at 16, I could get my license. So when I turned 16, we were actually in Florida, and I rode my first race at Hialeah, and I was second. Both my first two races were for my stepfather because I looked like a little young boy. I mean, they used to say, "Who is that little boy? Get him off the horses. He's too small." And so to get started, my stepfather's the one that gave me my first two mounts. And then I went out, you know, I just hustled for everybody else because I wanted to get away from my stepfather because he was abusive. So,
Karen, what did you weigh when you first started riding? You must have been,
I mean, it must have been a trainer's dream. You're getting the bug. I suppose you had to add weight probably to ride, right?
Well, yeah. So they assign weights. And as a bug rider, you get weight off your horse. So yeah. But I was so light. I probably started at 90 pounds, and the heaviest I ever was 105. But I used to ride with a big saddle, so the valets couldn't. They'd say, oh, ride or eat. You got to eat. You got to eat. They hated carrying my heavy saddle with all the lead back and forth from the jock's room to the horse, you know, because it was heavy. But it was a nice saddle. I found it an advantage, and I got to ride a lot of horses in stakes that were set at a light weight, 102, 103, 104, because a lot of the jocks were like 112.
How refreshing it must have been to watch Karen ride for any of us frustrated by jockeys who don't seem to ride their horses all the way to the finish, a frequent complaint these days.
You mentioned in your book that you got a reputation for bringing riding to the finish, which, by the way, is one of my everybody's big beefs these days, the riders who don't ride all the way to the finish, but you know, bringing in some long shots too. What were the odds on that on the first? When you ran second, what were the odds on your horse that day?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I never looked at the tote board. I rode everything to win. And if I couldn't win, I was second because we didn't have a lot of money. So I knew every place, even fifth place in New Jersey at that time, paid money. So every placing brought money in to keep the horses going in the barn. And I knew that.
Yep.
So if I wasn't going to be first, second, you know, I rode hard for every bit of a horse. You know, if I could be fourth over fifth, I was going to be fourth. So, but I rode everything to win, and I really didn't look at the tote board. You know, I didn't have a preconceived idea that this horse has no shot. They were all going to win. That's the way I looked at it.
I love that attitude. I love that.
Yeah, they were all going to win. That's how I went out there. Yep.
That's great.
Knowing that female jockeys were still a rarity at that time, you know Karen had a hard outer shell, a focus and a toughness that allowed her to survive and thrive in a difficult time.
So at the time, my impression, Karen, is that, you know, female jockeys were certainly around, but still a rarity, right? I mean,
well, when I rode ponies, there was girls and boys. So I never, and most girls were riding. So I really never thought of that male-female thing. And mm-hmm. So my idol was Steve Coffin because he was doing well in New York at 16. So I wanted to be like Steve. So I really didn't think about being a girl. And Monmouth accepted me right away because there weren't any girls. They couldn't say, oh, girls can't ride. They just took me at face value for my riding. Some of the big stables didn't accept me until, you know, the year I came back after New York, then everybody was putting me on horses. That was 1980, and I was actually leading rider that year. But New York was, but you know what? There weren't any girls in New York. There weren't any girls at Monmouth. They had a broom closet. That's like changed in a broom closet.
Oh, my gosh.
In the back, you know, so they, yeah, so.
There's no ping pong table in that broom closet then, right? There
was no, but over the years, they updated everything and upgraded. And then when they let the girls into the jocks room, the girls were like acting like they always, and I was like, this is a privilege, you know, don't be pushing it, you know, it's a privilege to be in here. Because I remembered when I wasn't allowed in there, you know.
I've said many times on this podcast that there are angels all around us. In Karen's case, not only figurative angels, but a literal angel as well.
You know, you mentioned at Monmouth getting your first kind of real break there. And there was a gentleman, and I want to go through some of the names that gave you support, but there's a gentleman there whose name I had not heard before, but Ed Rubenstein, who clearly was someone who meant a lot to you and was not afraid to be by your side and kind of help you in your career.
Right. He was a good agent, and he said, I'll help you out, but you're going to go back to school in the fall. And so I just said, okay. I knew I wasn't, but I was like, okay, you'll see, you know. So anyway, the more I rode, the more he started believing in me. And he just, in fact, when I left New Jersey, he took on another girl and another girl because of me. And because he didn't, like, he really didn't think I was serious. But then once we did good, he was sold on me. So he was a good man, and mm-hmm. but he was a good agent. He could talk the talk and double talk and get on the best horse.
Okay.
So I was the friendly one and he was the one that could get on the best horse and get people mad at him, but I could smooth it over. So we were kind of like a, you wanted one to be shrewd and one to be nice, kind of, you know, so you could play both ends. In New York, I had a nice agent, so I didn't do as well. But with Ed, he was like the car salesman, and I was just the nice guy. So it really worked out well that way.
Okay. Good cop, bad cop, right?
Yes, good cop, bad cop. Yes, yeah. And he was excellent. And he set me up with Bobby Lake in New York, even though Ed did not go to New York with me. He didn't want to leave his home. But okay. He set me up with Bobby Lake, which is the person that gave me a real shot in New York. And by the way, in New York, they didn't accept me because they had female riders, and they didn't like me because of that. They all called me Robin, and I'm like, who's Robin? But in New Jersey, they liked me because they didn't compare me to anybody.
And you know, speaking of New York, you mentioned a name in there that a lot of people, when they hear the name, they think of aggressive riding. And I think somehow they attribute that to his personality also. But you mentioned that Angel Cordero was someone who really, I don't want to say shepherded you, he didn't do that, but he seemed to at least accept you and encourage you, I guess.
Well, Angel's background was he was from Puerto Rico and he never got a shot, and he was black. He'd say, I was the black guy from Puerto Rico and nobody gave me a chance, and you girls have the same issue. So he took me as like an underdog that wouldn't get the mounts because he identified with it.
Okay.
And so he was really super. He had whips made for me. I know he got me mounts behind the scenes that mm-hmm. I'll never know about because he believed in me and he knew I was honest. He was very smart. He could ride every horse in a race. He knew who was doing what, who he wanted to ride next time. Angel, there's nobody that will ever be like him. He was extremely smart. You know, I'm not going to say he was somebody that you could trust, but he was on my side, which was nice.
Yeah. Obviously, it meant a lot to you. You can even tell just listening to you now how much it meant to you for someone like that to not be afraid to be your friend, right?
Well, he did test me. I mean, at the Meadowlands, he put me in a corner and I rode him right back. Like, you're not going to screw with me. And I think he respected that. And after that, he used to laugh. He used to say, I'd be on the rail. He'd come up behind me. He'd go, Carolina. And I'd pretend I didn't hear him. You know? So he was always trying to get an edge. Or he'd be in the gate and he goes, you going to go, baby? And I said, maybe. Maybe not. So he was always trying to get an edge. But he did. He always called me Carolina.
Inevitably, when we do these podcasts, reaching far back in history, names come up that sometimes ring a bell. Sometimes a very distant bell, and sometimes no bell is rung at all. But those snippets and byways are always worth paying attention to for those of us who love exploring the corners of the past that may have crept into shadow.
So, yeah, I mean, you went from New Jersey to New York. I mean, you were, I can't imagine, you know, 17 years old, Angel's there, Eddie Maple, Jorge Velasquez.
When I came to New York, it was very tough because all the big outfits had their riders and there was nothing really left for anybody. There weren't the little trainers like I had in New Jersey. I could ride mm-hmm. for the little guys, which is how I got started, long shots, little guys. But New York, there was a lot of big outfits that had their riders. And every race, they had their riders. There was really nothing really left over for any out-of-towners. I mean, Bailey couldn't get mounts. He and I couldn't get mounts. We played a lot of ping pong because it was all sewed up. Yeah, Jeff Fell... Bailey's big break was when Jeff Fell left and Jerry Bailey got the Mac Miller stable. And that's what put him on the map. But we couldn't get mounts because Macbeth came to New York, couldn't get mounts. It changed in the mid to late 80s. It changed. The big outfits kind of sold out. And if you were a leading rider in New Jersey, anywhere else, you could come and get mounts. Like Chris Antley did well, Julie Crone did well. It wasn't like that when Jerry and I came because it was a lot harder to get going. But I wanted to stay because the horses were good, the trainers were good, the riders were good. They were a little bit jealous in New Jersey because I did well, and there was some really nice riders, but some were very jealous. Mm-hmm. And New York was different. They were all, nobody was jealous. There was enough money to go around. There was clean riding and good horses, and so I wanted to be there and stay there, even if I didn't, you know, ride 8-9 a day.
Jeffrey Fell was a name with which I must confess I was not familiar. The shame is all mine. Jeffrey Fell was the leading Canadian rider in 1975, 1976, and 1977 before moving to New York. In 1980, he swept the Brooklyn, Suburban, and Marlboro Cup handicaps with Winter's Tale. In 1982, he steered 13-1 runaway groom to a hand-ride Travers victory, After Preakness winner Aloma's Ruler and Belmont Stakes winner Conquistador Cielo dueled each other into submission. Kentucky Derby winner Gato Del Sol finished off the board in that race. Fell retired after struggling with his weight in 1986. As I said, Karen had to have a tough outer shell to hold her own at the premier racing circuit in the country. Tough all around, in fact, to survive not just mentally, but physically also.
You said you wanted to be there and stay there. It's pretty interesting because you talked about your very first race was for a legendary trainer who was not appreciative of the effort that you were quite happy about.
Right. Well, that was Alan Jerkins, and he was very moody. And everybody I rode for was always nice in New Jersey, and I didn't know who Alan Jerkins was. I actually was riding for the owner. So what happened was my stepfather lost the horses, and they went to Jerkins, but the owner wanted me on the horse. So I didn't know anything about Alan Jerkins. And when he screamed at me after the race, I'm like, what the heck? This is crazy. I got upset because I didn't do anything wrong. But I found out later that's the way he was. He was very moody. And hard to read. And he was always very hard on jockeys.
Right. That's the reputation. Yeah. Yeah. Finished second by like a nose, right? I mean, so not like you weren't right in it, right?
Yeah, but you couldn't figure out Alan Jerkins. He could get mad if you won. I mean, he was very unpredictable. Even going by the barn, one day I'm looking at the board and he had all these weird things written down on his blackboard. And he was like, PPPGH. And I'm like, you know, what does that mean? Doesn't mean gallop, doesn't mean... And he goes, you know, like a horse gallop. And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, just he marched to the beat of his own drum. And people that worked with him loved him. But I just couldn't read him that well. I kind of didn't really go by much. I probably would have gotten more mounts, but I just couldn't kind of deal with that. So anyway, my agent Fred used to say, go by, he likes you. If he's like that to you, he's mean to you, he likes you. And I'm like, whatever. So, he was a good horseman, just different.
You mentioned Karen, too. One of the things that really was very striking in the book, you had more than just a near-death experience on the track. You had I'm going to let you describe what happened to you.
Well, it was at Saratoga, and I was going into the first turn, and an apprentice was coming over, and I had a couple horses inside me, and there was nowhere to go. So he ended up shutting me off. I clipped heels, and that's all I remember until I was floating up, and I saw my body down below on a stretcher with two doctors in a room, and I'm like, I must be dying because I'm not in my body. And all I could think about was how small I was because I was up pretty high. And I wasn't thinking about the horses. I was just thinking about getting back to make things right with my mother because of the personal stuff I was going through. But anyway, I wanted to get back. I stopped at what I thought was the ceiling and the wall up high. It was the first aid room in the track. Mm-hmm. I found out later. I went back 9 years later. I was writing my book. That was 1981. I was writing my book in 1989, and I had broken my back for the fourth time. Hmm. And I went back to riding again, and I had another spill at Saratoga, which is only 1 month out of the year. And what were the odds that I would have another spill the same spot on the track? Four horses went down. And I wasn't hurt. And actually, my agent went running across the infield, and we got in the ambulance, and I had told him about my out-of-body experience. So I said, Dominic, maybe now I can find out what happened 9 years ago when I went down here. Mm-hmm. And it was the same doctor in the first aid room, and he confirmed that I had died. And he showed me the room. It was a very small room, and what I saw when I went up when I had died, what I saw was a big room with an oak desk in the back and nurses, and my arm was up over my head. So my shoulder had been dislocated. So the doctor was showing me a little room, and I said, this isn't what I saw. Well, it turns out I had seen, when I walked through the first aid room, I had seen the nurse's station with the big oak desk next to the little room, and I was up real high, and I saw the two rooms like they were one. So I thought it was a big room, and I wasn't on the ceiling. I was obviously about to cross into another dimension, which I wanted to turn and go when I had the experience, but I also wanted to get back. So,
yeah, that's wow.
It was more real than being in your body. You're so much more real out of your body. You know, we're not our body. We're definitely more than that.
There was one other name to Karen's highly readable book, Racing with My Shadow, brought out that I was not aware of.
You know, Karen, you mentioned in the course of that you had broke your back in that, you know, four times in your riding career. And one of the names that I came across, just in terms of the dangerousness of the sport and what you folks, you know, on horseback go through, and it wasn't a name with which I was familiar, to be honest with you, but someone who obviously you were very friendly with was David Ashcroft. And if you don't mind kind of telling his story, too, because I was really...
Well, I cut out of the book what happened to him. We were dating as, you know, we were 17 years old, like kind of like high school sweethearts. We were both riding at Monmouth. He was a leading bug rider in Florida. I was leading bug rider at New York, and we both went to Monmouth. And so we ended up kind of dating, going to the movies and everything, and really, really nice guy. But I had other issues from my past and my stepfather that, you know, we could get into. But so I really didn't feel comfortable in any kind of a real relationship. And he wanted to get married young. And so anyway, so we broke up under very good terms. He went to Florida. I went to New York. And he got paralyzed a month later. He went down at Calder Racetrack, broke his neck, a horse. It was actually a gap that all the horses were making left-hand turns after the gate. They come out of the gate and make a left for the gap.
Okay.
And Calder had admitted, they were going to fix the gap. But before they did that, David's horse made a left and he broke his neck. And, I flew down there to see him and, he's still paralyzed from the neck down.
Yeah.
And that was 1981. And so, and I always thought that should be me because I could, you know, I could read. I liked doing stuff that was off the track, and he was a real outdoorsman.
Mm.
So it ended up okay because he was engaged at the time. I mean, he really wanted to get married, so he got engaged right after we broke up. But she wasn't very nice, and I guess she was after his money or whatever because he had a really rough time. She was very abusive to him when he was paralyzed. Mm. So anyway, he ended up marrying his nurse who met him as a quadriplegic.
Okay.
And they have two kids now, and we're still in touch. And,
God bless him. Yeah.
Yeah. But many, 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 many people get paralyzed and dead. I've ridden a couple races where people have been killed in front of me. So it's a rough sport, you know, but you don't think about that. He used to tell me, you got to quit, you keep breaking your back. And I said, what about you? He said, I never get hurt.
Hmm.
And so there's just no rhyme or reason to who ends up paralyzed and who ends up walking away fine.
You know,
it's like Russian roulette.
One of the things I've learned, there's no rhyme or reason in this life. A lot of it is, you know, just roll.
Well, I have a strong faith, so, you know, after my out-of-body experience, and I do believe that God has his hand on everything, and even the bad things, he makes good out of it, like my book and my story, my personal story has helped a lot of people, so the bad that I went through personally has been used for a lot of good.
I believe that
obviously, there's a lot more to Karen's story. We'll go into that. Choose your adjective, dark, fascinating, inspiring, actually all three, side of Karen's story next week on the Can-Do Horse Racing Podcast. We hope you'll join us then. In the meantime, may good health, happiness, and gratitude for both be yours today and always.
I got the horse right here.